Hi, I'm Ali Hassan, host of CBC's Laugh Out Loud. Do you like to laugh? Because we're serving up big laughs each week. We feature comedians from across Canada. You might already be fans of some of them, and others might be new discoveries. We record emerging comedians and established pros in front of live audiences all across the country, and we promise that you'll be literally laughing out loud. You can find Laugh Out Loud on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So usually the Venice Biennale makes headlines because it's a really big deal in the art world. But this year, the show is in the news for a different reason. The artist chosen to represent Israel has shut down her exhibit. Today you're going to hear about an artist protest on the world's largest art stage. I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Listen, if you're not familiar with the Venice Biennale, let me first tell you about it, okay? It is arguably the world's biggest and most prestigious art exhibition. It's like a little Olympics in that every country chooses an artist to represent it, and then those artists exhibit their work in Venice. The Biennale officially opens this weekend, and when it does, one exhibit is going to be closed. Ruth Battir, who is the artist representing Israel, is refusing to open her exhibit. There's a sign on the door of the Israel Pavilion that says the exhibit will only open when, quote, a ceasefire and hostage release agreement is reached. Kate Brown is the senior editor at ArtNet News, and she's in Venice covering the Biennale. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, I really appreciate it. Listen, it's late afternoon in Venice right now. What has the mood been like at the Israel Pavilion?
Yeah, well, today it's quiet in terms of protests. Okay. What's going on online, of course, is another story. But, you know, on the ground, as you said, the doors of the pavilion are closed. They've been closed since Monday when they were supposed to open for a press preview for journalists.
Yeah.
And then yesterday at around 11 a.m., about 100 pro-Palestine supporters marched through the Giardini, you know, making declarations in support of Palestine. And they marched from the Israeli pavilion through to the U.S., French, and British and German pavilions. So, like, to explain a little bit about these pavilions, it's this garden, and there's all these kind of embassies that each the country can, like, represent their artists every 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like an Epcot World Showcase, World's Fair type of thing. And of course, all of these artists are sponsored by their government. So it really becomes this kind of showcase of also a lot of the political tensions that are going on in the world. And so We weren't surprised, but of course, it becomes, you know, a litmus test for different political social issues that are playing out.
So I want to come back to the protests in just a moment, but I think the thing that you just talked about is important to talk about, which is the Biennale is kind of like the Olympics. You know, the Biennale is sort of like this idea of, like, every country chooses the artist that represent it, and then send that artist to Venice. Each country gets their own pavilion to showcase that artist. And then given this current conflict between Israel and Hamas, there were some people who thought that Israel should be banned from participating. How do you think the Biennale organizers responded to those calls?
Yeah. So, of course, it's the artist was announced in September, but since about February, there have been calls that the pavilion should not be open. And so long as there's a war going on in Gaza.
Yeah.
And a group actually issued this open letter, which in February, that got 24,000 signatures, basically saying, quote, no genocide pavilion at the Venice Biennale. And they stated, you know, as a precedent that there was a ban on the South African pavilion from 1968 to 1993. And
during the apartheid.
Yeah. And but regardless of that, the Biennale stood strong on their position and said, you know, that we recognize that Israel as a sovereign state and all sovereign states do get to show at the Biennale in an official capacity. Mm-hmm. So, for, you know, example, like there's no Palestine pavilion because Italy doesn't recognize it as a sovereign state, for example.
Right. So we should say, until earlier this week, it looked like the Israel Pavilion would, in fact, be open like regular, right? Like, in an interview published on Monday by an Israeli newspaper, one of the curators said, quote, we believe that artists should not be silenced. We are going to set up the exhibition with the thought that it's a platform from which to make a voice heard. That was on Monday, right? And then by Wednesday, you know, you're writing articles about how this Israel Pavilion is closed. How surprised were you by this decision? How unusual is it for artists to, like, come to the Biennale and then go, you know what? I am not going to open my exhibit to the public.
It's fairly unusual. Of course, it's a huge opportunity for artists to present work here.
Right.
But in terms of like, I think everyone was expecting something that would happen, that there was a lot of anticipation in the air when we were all traveling here, you know, because the Biennale is this place where you can get your message heard around the world very quickly because all the country's journalists are here, their cultural representatives are here. If you want to make a message heard, like this is one of the places that you can do it. So we were expecting something would happen. You know, I should say also like in 2022, for example, the artists also withdrew from the Russian pavilion after the war in Ukraine had started. So there, you know, these things do happen. But it's hard to know like how far in advance Ruth Patir, the artist who is representing Israel, and her curators made this decision. You know, they said that they were hoping that by the time April would come around there, that there would be a ceasefire, that the hostages would be released. And so, you know, I think from what I understand from the reporting is that the closer it got to it, the more untenable it was that they could open their pavilion and have, you know, quote unquote, business as usual.
Yeah.
And, you know, the head of the Venice Biennale also called it a courageous decision.
I want to just like maybe situate people in this decision making process. Like every country gets to, you know, its minister of culture or whatever sort of mechanisms exist, end up choosing the artist to send to Venice. Ruth Patir was chosen in September, so before the attack on October 7th, chosen as the artist is going to represent Israel here. For anyone curious, how would you describe Ruth Patir's work?
Yeah, she's a filmmaker and a media artist.
Yeah.
She looks at like historical narratives and often gender issues. And as you said, she was announced before Hamas's attack. And her work in Venice, actually, which, you know, we haven't seen, but is called Motherland. And it's a very personal work about her own experience with fertility clinics, like male-dominated fertility clinics and the male-dominated medical system. But of course, it also speaks, according to the press text, like more widely about womanhood and the damage, you know, reaped on the woman's body throughout, like, you know, war. So in a way, it also speaks to the present moment very directly, according to the press release.
Kate, the doors to the Israel Pavilion are locked. The lights are off. You know, you can't access the exhibit. But then you have demonstrators outside the building, you know, and those demonstrators, they don't think that that's enough. Like, so they're protesting outside the Israel Pavilion because they don't think that it's enough for the exhibit to be shut. What are they saying in terms of why they gather outside this pavilion at all?
Yeah, they said, quote, they don't applaud empty opportunistic gestures, time for maximum press coverage. And they think that the entire pavilion should be shut down. I don't even think that my understanding is that even the sign that called for that they won't open until there's a ceasefire and the release of the hostages was appropriate from my understanding. And I guess that's also because, you know, you can see the video work when you look through the glass doors of the pavilion and then you can see this sign. You know, one might wonder, like, sometimes a full closure, you might just walk by it and not notice, but this also draws attention to the absence, according to some. So, yeah, and there are more works on view that you can't see, but they were really adamant that the entire thing should be shut down. The video work, they directly said the video work should not even be playing.
I guess I'm conscious of the fact that we've been talking around what's happening like around the art, but let's maybe talk about the art itself. You've been looking at all the exhibits this year at the Biennale. How much does the range of work that's come to the Biennale this year reflect the fact that there's so many different geopolitical conflicts that we're seeing right now?
I mean, it's truly incredible. The biennial seems more diverse than ever before.
Yeah.
There's a Congolese collective that is presenting at the Dutch Pavilion, calling attention to, you know, the colonial extractivism that took place in the Congo. Mm-hmm. You've got all kinds of, you know, Poland has a Ukrainian artist showing work. So it really feels that it is a reflection of the world, but also reflects the world through multiple perspectives and prisms of opinion. And that's quite beautiful. And, you know, art is really relevant to help us comprehend the world in difficult moments when problems seem so massive and when humanity seems like it's at such an impasse. Like, art can really build bridges and empathy. And it's just, it has been really moving and poignant to walk around here the last few.
You mentioned that for the past couple of years, you know, Russia has not been participating in 2022. Right. Particularly in 2022, Russia did not participate. That's the case again this year. They've lent their pavilion to another country to use. We should say in 2022, the year of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Ukraine erected this scorched wooden structure. And then this year, they're drawing attention to the war again. What do you make of the way that the Venice Biennale has kind of become a place where you can talk about or sort of express viewpoints or sort of, I guess, like responses to these major international conflicts? Is that typically what the Biennale is for?
I think more so than ever before, it has become like that, you know. Yeah. And I think also, as societies also realize that so many perspectives have been overlooked on the world stage, there's a lot of more, like as I said, more diversity and more histories being brought into these spaces. And so it's been really inspiring. It holds up a mirror to the world in a really important way.
Kate, I've been so interested with the story, with the way that people have been reacting to the story, because it's one way that people are using art as protest that I think many people didn't necessarily see coming. But now that it's here, and there's just like the idea of connecting art to nationalism at all becomes so interesting, because of course it's going to get so fraught kind of immediately. I really appreciate you being our guide through this. I think we're going to come back to the story because this pavilion may well open, right? So Ruth Pattier says it's not going to open until there's a ceasefire and a hostage deal. So hopefully we'll open. The Biennale runs all the way until November. But in the meantime, I appreciate your time. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, I hope it will open too. Thank you so much.
Of course. My pleasure. Kate Brown is a senior editor at ArtNet News. She's at this year's Venice Biennale. The exhibition, by the way, opens on Saturday and runs until November. For more on the story about Israel's pavilion, you can go to CBC News.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements?
I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Look, I think the best place to start this next conversation is with this. I'm delighted to tell you that this is brand new music from Pearl Jam. They are back with their 12th album. It's called Dark Matter. You can stream that as of midnight tonight. But if you're a real hardcore fan, you're not going to be streaming this thing, okay? You're going to go and get the special vinyl edition, because that's what you do. It's among a whole bunch of other limited editions that are going to be available only this Saturday for Record Store Day. And if you're not familiar with Record Store Day, let me tell you. Record Store Day is kind of like Christmas for music geeks. You get to go to your favorite record shops to buy these rare album releases that are available for sale for, that's it. That's one day only. You might have heard that vinyl sales have been growing year over year since 2008, which is wild. What's been kind of cool, though, is that more recently we've also seen more and more people returning to other old formats like DVDs, like cassettes. So what is going on here exactly? Are these shifts just fads? Are we starting to see basically a big shift basically away from streaming, because streaming has changed so much of how we consume entertainment? Here to help me answer some of these questions are two physical media enthusiasts, Emma Roth and Mark Masters. Mark, Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Of course. My pleasure. Mark, I'm going to start with you. As I mentioned, this interest in vinyl has been happening for a minute. It's been happening for over 15 years now. You know, right back to the dawn of the streaming era, basically. In 2023, 43 million vinyl records were sold in the U.S. That's about $1.4 billion in revenue. Here in Canada, nearly 7 million records were sold, up from 5 million just a couple of years ago. What do you make of all this growth when there's so many people that can just go to YouTube, go to Spotify, and listen to their music there, but they're like, no, I want to do it the much harder way?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, 15 years is a significant amount of time. When it first started happening, I think a lot of people thought this is just sort of a fad.
Yeah.
It got kind of covered that way. But I mean, it's sustained for a while. And of course, it's never going to be back to the levels it was before streaming, before CDs even. Mm-hmm. But I do think a lot of people, there's a nostalgia aspect to it. There's people who grew up with vinyl who still like it. But there's a lot of younger people who are interested, who I think are using it not only as a way to own something and to have, because before streaming, the way you identified yourself as a music fan was what you owned as much as what you listened to, right? So yeah. I think that's an important thing. And I think a lot of people also are kind of getting turned off by streaming. It's got a little bit less of a personal appeal to them, and a way to sort of stand out against that and say, I'm not interested in it, is to buy physical media.
I think people who are watching us right now live on YouTube can see what's behind you, but people who are listening on the radio can't. So I'm just going to describe this beautiful wall of vinyls behind you that you're like, this is, mm-hmm. you look like you're in your treasure room. You know what I mean? Like that's sort of what I'm seeing right now, which is great. It's very lovely. Emma, recently you wrote a piece for The Verge about another kind of physical media that you've sort of had re-enter your life recently, and that's DVDs. Dude, what? Emma, what brought you back to DVDs?
You know, I didn't really expect to take this path either, but to be honest, like I subscribe to so many streaming services, and a lot of it is taking up a lot of my data on my monthly limit for my ISP. And I just decided, I was like, you know what, let me just go buy DVDs instead. So that way I don't have to spend extra money, like when I go over my data cap. And there's just something about it too, how it kind of takes the choice away when it comes to streaming. Like it's definitely not as overwhelming as looking at a bunch of different stuff to watch on Netflix. It's much less intimidating.
Well, and Netflix talks all the time about how like the one of the most dangerous moments for Netflix as an app is when you find yourself in the infinite scroll. You're like, I don't know, what is the thing I'm going to watch? Because sometimes like you're just doing that for 10 minutes and no one can find anything to like actually watch. And then at that point, you're feeling stressed, and Netflix is no longer a source of joy. It's a source of like, you know, negative feelings because you're overwhelmed with choice. But it's interesting to me that you arrived at this epiphany right around the time that Best Buy announced it's no longer going to be selling DVDs. How have you gone about building up your collection? Because the places you go to do that, they seem to be no longer interested in even carrying those types of media anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely dwindling in terms of like where you can get a lot of DVDs. But I've been going to like thrift stores, like you can find them at Goodwill or sometimes the flea market. But my most reliable has been Walmart, which has a $5 DVD bin that I just kind of sift through, and I don't have to deal with like clicking through a bunch of different titles. I can just pick it up, read the back, and decide if I want to watch it. I mean, it might just be like a movie that's been released like 10 years ago, but you know, it's something to watch.
Yeah, you don't. You won't have the little percentage recommendation from Netflix that's like, hey, we're pretty sure you're going to like this. You just kind of go, I think there's enough here for me to go, all right, I'll try it. Mark, it's interesting to hear, I think, Emma talk about how inexpensive DVDs are, because when you look at vinyl, you're spending $40 for like a regular new album, never mind fancy reissue sets. There have also been all these chronic supply chain issues because the number of vinyl pressing plants in the world is limited. So what do you say to someone who like looks at all of this and goes, why are people spending all that money on this form of media? Like that would strike somebody as surprising, given that you can get it for the $10 a month that you spend on a streaming service.
Right. No, that's an interesting point. And I think that even some people who do buy vinyl think that it's gotten a little out of control in terms of how much it costs and how complicated it is to find it and for labels to make it and things like that. But
sure.
I mean, personally, that my bias toward that is that it's opened up an opportunity for the other formats, particularly cassettes. Cassettes are cheaper to make now and faster, and a lot of especially small labels who want to have physical product to sell at their shows or to their fans online are turning toward cassettes because you can offer a cassette for $5-$10 where the vinyl is going to cost maybe four times that, and people are more likely to buy it even if they won't necessarily have a cassette player. It's a way to support the label, support the bands.
What do you say to someone who looks at the cassette revival and goes like, this has got to be some kind of hipster fad, it's definitely going to go away?
Yeah. Well, I don't think they're necessarily 100% wrong about that. I mean, there is a part of it that's nostalgic.
but
I think people are finding there was always a value in cassettes as a sort of a personal format to be able to tape your own music, make mixtapes and things like that had, you know, more personal investment than making like a playlist on a streaming service. And also these labels that are taking advantage of the cheapness and – Also, there's other aspects of the cassette that vinyl doesn't have in terms of the way you can make the artwork, the information you can put inside of it, the way you can put more music on it, the way when someone's listening to it, they kind of have to listen to the whole thing, which kind of helps your music. So I think there are a lot of positive things about cassettes that still exist from the time they started that people are still valuing.
I'll tell you what's interesting with this is nobody's been like, you know what we should bring back is CD players. Like, that hasn't happened yet, and I am grateful for it. Emma, you mentioned the idea, like, the big catalyst for your move towards DVDs is this idea of, like, you know, I'm being charged too much for my data. I want, you know, enough of this. But is there something about the experience of watching a movie on a DVD that feels substantially different to you in terms of just, like, how you approach art, the art that you consume, when it's on DVD versus when you get it on streaming?
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit less intimidating, I guess, when you're watching a movie like on a DVD, because you can just kind of have a night, like a movie night, like you can set a date, just chill out, watch a movie. You don't have to go through the process of picking anything.
Yeah.
And it's just much more kind of relaxed, in my opinion. Like, I feel like there is a stress that is associated with picking something out. And that's something I deal with on a daily basis. When I get off work, I'm like, it's nice to just be able to pop in a DVD I bought like a couple days ago and just watch it.
I gotta tell you, I've one of our producers here has been pitching me this movie that is a Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney movie that I have not seen, and I can't find it on a streaming service. I have literally every streaming service, and this movie is not available on any of the streaming services. It is called Out of Sight, and I hear it's good. You know, I hear it's good, but I just there's nowhere for me to find it. As someone who has every single streaming service and I still can't find certain movies, what do we give up, do you think, when we put all our eggs in the streaming basket, so to speak?
Yeah, that's another reason why DVDs are kind of good, is because you can find a lot of things that streaming services don't have. Like, there's more obscure films that they don't pick up. I mean, and even like popular titles. Like, I was having trouble finding Transformers on a streaming service that I subscribe to. So I ended up just buying it at Walmart.
Yeah. Like, okay.
I mean, it's sure it's not in 4K, but, you know, it's at least I can watch it.
I really like the idea of you being like, I want the finest cinema of yore. And then the thing that you land on is Transformers. I really love this idea. Mark, there's something comforting about the notion of owning a piece of media, because this has happened to me a few times. I would download a version of a song on a streaming service, and then it would change. The artist would go, I'm going to make a different choice on this. Kanye West, I think, being like one of the most famous examples of this, because he tinkered with a couple of albums after he put them up available on streaming. But when you consume, you know, music through a streaming service, you don't own it. It does not belong to you. You're sort of borrowing it from their library, as opposed to the idea of like ownership. When I look at this beautiful wall behind you, and like you own all those versions, that if an artist chooses to change their version of a song, they're like not entitled to change your physical copy of it. What do you make of our changing relationship to ownership right now?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, there's also the issue, it's not as big, but what Emma was talking about certain music going on and off certain services, and so you're used to listening to it, and suddenly it's not there anymore. And you're right, artists changing their music on the services. And yeah, those are all issues that you definitely bypass if you own the music.
Right.
And, you know, music before streaming, that was the way you identified yourself as a music fan, as I mentioned before, by what you owned.
Yeah.
And I do think that some of these streaming services have kind of disconnected that, so that you don't feel as close to the music. I mean, like putting out money for a piece of vinyl means that you've invested in it.
Right.
You know, and a streaming service, most people forget that they even are subscribing to so many. Mm-hmm. So there's really not the connection there. And I think that just that personal kind of intimate connection with things is just only happens if you own a physical copy of something.
Emma, do you feel like you are leading the charge of a new frontier when it comes to your generation and its relationship to DVDs? Or are you kind of alone out here? You know, I worry about you.
I mean, honestly, like, I don't really know anybody else in my circle that collects DVDs, but I mean, there has been kind of a rise in it. Like the Oppenheimer film, I believe it got sold out, like the physical
on DVD.
Copies
that's
of
right.
It.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think that there is kind of a surge in that. in a way, and I guess in some small way, but
it's you and the Oppenheimer people. I love that. I love that. I love this image of you guys. Continue. Sorry. Continue.
Oh, no. I mean, but yeah, I think it definitely is a little bit less common.
Yeah.
Among my circle.
It was interesting to see Oppenheimer be this moment for physical media, because I believe that DVD like sold out across America. Like people like wanted to own it in 4K on DVD, and within like a couple of weeks, it was completely sold out. So you know what? That tells me you're not completely alone out there. I haven't made the same jump that you guys have made. I'm not ready to make the same jump that you guys have made. But you know what? You got me thinking about it. You got me at least thinking about being like, how do I find this movie? This out of sight movie. And it turns out no streaming service out there can help me. Mark, Emma, I appreciate it. I will leave you be with your physical media. Thank you for your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Emma Roth is a tech news writer for The Verge. She was in Port Lucie, Florida. And Mark Masters is the author of High Bias, The Distorted History of the Cassette Tape. He was in Gilbert, Arizona. That is it for the show today. Listen, tomorrow, Taylor Swift. We got to talk about it. The album drops tonight at midnight. I will see you there. And then I will see you tomorrow morning. Can't wait to talk about it. I will see you then. My name is Al-Amin. This is Commotion.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.